Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Whole Foods Market creates win-win partnerships with our suppliers, and we'd love to tell their stories. Red Jacket Orchards is a family-owned farm in the Finger Lakes of the Hudson Valley that's grown for decades alongside Whole Foods Market. Their apples, pears, ciders, and juices are some of New York's best and seasonal staples for any kitchen. Come have a taste in one of our six Manhattan locations.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. Every week, Wednesday at 11, we tune into HeritageRadioNetwork.com and we're talking about the most important topic in the world. Actually, maybe the most important topic for 2012. Taste. Happy New Year, everybody. And since it's the new year and since restaurants are everyone's favorite sport, at least everybody I know's favorite sport, eating in restaurants, I thought we would start off the year with a conversation about what's in store for 2012. And with me, we're welcoming back Adam Rappaport, editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit magazine. Hi, Adam.
Hello, Mitchell.
Welcome back to Bushwick, where there is no cell phone service.
Thank you very much.
And more importantly, perhaps, Andrew Knowlton, who is restaurant and drinks editor of Bon Appetit, but you might know him better as the foodist. He answers all of your questions about where to eat and what to do with food and all the important things in life. Hi, Andrew.
Thanks,
welcome
Mitchell.
To Taste Matters.
Very nice.
So, guys, what's going on? What are you looking forward to in 2012? When it comes to restaurants and food, tell us something.
I have no. I just asked Knowlton, and he tells me what's going on. So, Knowlton, what do we got in 2012?
You mean the 100 emails I get a day saying, "Oh, I have a dinner tonight, and you can't come, but can you tell me where to go?" Sure,
exactly.
Do you really get 100 emails a day?
I get quite a few from random folks, mostly from advertising people, who want to go to Teresi and they need a table for. At 8 o'clock for eight people.
Funny, we were there yesterday with eight people at 8:30. Actually, just four people. But
so you can get in there. I can't even get.
I have not been to the new Teresi. Actually, that's a big topic here in New York right now. And Mitchell, if you can just explain for the listeners who haven't been to Teresi how it changed.
Well, it was first come, first served, prefix, $50 originally, four-course tasting menu.
And tiny restaurant, tiny. 10 tables maybe.
Yeah, that hasn't really changed. They've added a table, but they've taken some away. But now they're also doing, you can make a reservation online, and they're also doing two tables a night. They're doing a really elaborate 20-course tasting menu, which we had the benefit of enjoying last night well into the night. Yeah.
Well, how is it? How has the food changed? Because for people who haven't been, it's creative Italian with all American products, some hints of Chinatown here and there.
It's even more creative and more un-Italian in some ways. I mean, there are references. It was funny because the menu is really funny. Like, they present things shaped as cigarettes with ashes of poppy seeds, and they have all sorts of allusions to old New York things and immigrant things. But if you don't get them, as my partner Nate didn't get any of them, he said, "I don't know what you're laughing about, but this is delicious." So you don't really need to eat it on
and
that way.
How much is the prefix now, the big one?
It's $120. But it's so worth it. I mean, it's hard to express how well made everything is. Yeah. It's just so beautifully presented and really casual.
And they're still sticking to their only in America, made in America products.
Yeah, and they're most. I mean, those products include manischewitz and all sorts of neat things.
Golden's mustard and with the spetzel, the gnocchi.
The peppers, the
B and B.
Those didn't appear. B&G. I mean, it's much B&G less Italian, peppers. I would say. Yeah. Even the pasta course was lobster Cantonese.
Yeah.
And so, let's talk about this idea because one of the things
I had sweetbreads there once that essentially was General Cho's chicken.
Amazing.
But with sweetbreads.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, they actually serve a sort of General Cho's chicken now as one of the amuse-bouche. And all I could think of was if you had a plate of these things, you could die, like after eating a plate and go to heaven. I mean, it was just so delicious. But let's talk about this trend of these really casual, I mean, there are no tablecloths. There happen to be very fine dishware and beautiful antique silver and stuff that they're using. But is this something going on around the, I mean, is it just in this one particular place?
No. I think it's been going on for a while. And I think, you know, as with a lot of things, you look at David Chang and Momofuku, and those types of restaurants where the focus is on the food. And there's notion like, you know what? No disrespect to Adam Tahani or David what's his name?
Rockwell,
but we don't need to spend $1 million on the interior. Right. This is, let Jean Georges and those guys, Danielle, do it, but we can open a great restaurant. We worked at Jean Georges and Danielle. We know how to cook like a mother bleeper, so let's just focus on the food. Bare wood tables, benches half the time. We're at Roberta's right now, which I think is some of the best food in the city, best food in the country, hands down.
Right.
And you're like in basically a camp dining room here.
Right, right.
In a good way.
I do think, though, that, when you go to a place like Teresi or you go to a casual place where food is the focus, that over the past couple of years, though, for too long, though, service has suffered for that reason, and it's kind of been like, it is that David Chang, and he'd be the first one to admit it. It's kind of like the F you customer, if you don't like it, go someplace else.
By the way, guys, we're an internet radio. You can curse.
Okay. Oh, there are no censors. Yeah.
So I think that the motherfucker. No, I think that's gonna in 2012. I think you're gonna see. Not people getting stuffy, and there's not going to be captains and maitre d's at Roberta's or Momofuku, but you're going to see a refocus on service, I think, because that's what's really suffered.
And Alan service Richmond, at these casual places.
At these casual places.
Alan Richmond documented that well in his GQ article on M. Wells in Long Island City, which was another one of these places with really high caliber chef in an old diner, and the service, anyone who's been there, we all love the food, but you're waiting 45 minutes for a table that you already have a reservation for.
Yeah, it sucks.
You sit down, you're waiting 30 minutes for a glass of water, and I personally find that offensive and excusable. As much as I like that place, I like the food, I like the vibe,
but
it's annoying.
How do you think you'd do that? If you only have 12 seats, you don't have a bar or cocktail lounge you can wait in. There are some benefits to a David Rockwell or Adam Tahani $15 million build-up restaurant.
You know what? Honestly, though, the thing is with these places, and I think one thing to give props to Danny Meyer, it doesn't cost a restaurant any more to be polite and thoughtful.
Right.
It does not cost you a cent. And if you're the host and if you're a waiter, be polite, be thoughtful, be mindful of what your customer is going through. And then on the other side, as a manager, you have to institute a system that works. And we're, Nolan and I have gone through this year at the magazine, relaunching Bon Appetit. It's like trying to figure out how to work something on a productive schedule. I understand that's challenging, but you've got to work at it. You got to figure it out.
And it's your responsibility as the purveyor.
You can't charge people $120 for a tasting menu and not have good service.
Right. And the other thing, too, is if you're opening a restaurant in Brooklyn and you think you're off the radar, well, we all know Brooklyn is on the radar. It is like the big blip. So to act like you can get away with not being a real restaurant, but you can still charge $32 for a strip steak and French fries and just because you're in Brooklyn, I think that attitude is like you can't – those restaurants can't be successful anymore in Brooklyn or Queens or wherever. There's no like – even Roberta's here. Like I think they realized after a certain point that they had to get serious and it had to be infrastructure and it had to be like, yes, we're a cool – restaurant that's not going to do things as usual, but you gotta there's nothing wrong with picking up a Danny Meyer book on hospitality, even if you work at Roberta's, what I mean?
Right.
And I've always had great times here. Most fun restaurant in the country. I always come here and have a good time. It's raucous, it's fun, but the food comes out in a timely manner and it's a good time.
Delicious. Yeah,
and it's delicious on from high to low.
Okay, outside of Brooklyn, any places that you see gurglings of this kind of, of any kind of food trend that you're interested in? You travel around a lot, Andrew.
We do the top 10 restaurant list in September, our restaurant issue.
Look at your number two restaurant, Mission.
Yeah,
Chinese
Mission Street Chinese in San Francisco. I think it's an amazing place, and it's that same suffers sometimes from that same lack of kind of the food comes first and the service sometimes.
They took over an old school sort of cheap
greasy Chinese
which
place.
They haven't hardly changed.
They haven't changed, and they're doing and the chef there, Danny Bowen, hasn't even been to the Sichuan province. He's from Oklahoma. Korean descent and does his interpretation. The fact that he can do that kind of food and people embrace it says a lot about American food and the consumer right now. But I think those kind of places, and I've heard rumors about maybe them branching out and going across the U.S. Mission Street. So
really? Wow.
They're looking for other cities that have looking a Mission Street.
Yeah.
Are you serious? You know? No. I thought they were looking for other dive Chinese restaurants that are being underused.
It's funny, Mitchell. You and I actually both talked. I wrote that New York Times reporter on Sunday about Charlie Trotter's closing in Chicago. And when I was speaking to her, one thing that...
It's still open?
Hey.
Ooh, not harsh.
Anymore. Well, for another Come few on. Months. But it's interesting. Like, the you know, Charlie Trotter's did not change, and his commitment to excellence, to quote the Oakland Raiders, did not change, but the restaurant landscape did. And we are used to restaurants like Roberta's and Momofuku and Terese now, and there you had a restaurant was still was very rigid in its, you know, multi-course tasting menus and wine service and flour, all that sort of stuff. And, like, you know, God bless him for sticking to his guns, but what people want from restaurants is not the same as it was 20 years ago or 15 years ago or 10 years ago.
So let's talk about that a little bit. What has changed, and what has changed about those people, but also about what they want? What do you think? I mean, I have a few theories. But
in talking into the microphone, Mitchell.
In terms of the consumer, what has changed?
Yeah, I mean, obviously something drastic. I think something big has shifted in the food loving consumer from when we started.
Well, listen,
Adam,
there will always be people who like the great service and whatnot, but I think just it's a much more of a cultural sort of situation where, you know, this is we've got, you know, everything from Twitter to the internet, everyone's informed, everything's much more out there, everything is, there's not, you know, the curtain's been lifted off, you know, it's this whole Wizard of Oz thing. It's like the pretense of like fanciness is not what it was anymore. And you look at photography in magazines, we're using real people, we're not using models anymore. Right. You know, it's much more, everyone's on Twitter giving the real thoughts, and it's much more real right now. So I think some of the spending $150,000 on flower arrangements a year feels a little sort of out of date.
Interesting.
Right. And I think, yeah, I mean, I think the casualization of the American dining scene has been the most significant thing that's happened over the 10 years. And, you know, when we were getting into the business 10, 15 years ago, you know, you went to Danielle, was a nice night out. And now, although some of us still go to Danielle when you do want that, more often than not, you're going to a Terese or you're going to the Dutch, because those chefs have chosen to do the same caliber of food that they were doing at Cafe Bleu, they're now doing at their restaurants, because people are actually cooking, I think, what they want to eat in the atmosphere they want to eat, not what they think they're supposed to do. I mean, I'm not saying Danielle doesn't enjoy going to his own restaurant, Danielle.
But Danielle is packed. Le Bernardin is packed.
Le Bernardin also remodeled. And Eric felt like, you know, we need to modernize this restaurant as well as we're doing. We have our 3 Michelin stars, et cetera, et cetera. And he has said that. It's like we felt we needed a change.
But I don't think you can look at Le Bernardin and Danielle and hold those like, oh, fine dining's not dead. Those are like, you're talking about the creme de la creme of restaurants in the world. If you look at that second tier of those high-end restaurants, I mean, Le Grand Louis made it, but then all those ones that have been, you know, Lutèce and all those that died.
There's one Danielle and there's one Le Bernardin.
Lutèce was the greatest restaurant in the world at one time.
Oh, it was. But I'm saying all those middle, it's either you're going to Danielle or you're going, you know, you're slumming it at Momofuku.
You know, but also,
Terese.
Another thing about that, I think you got to understand that, you know, Mitchell, like, you or I go to Danielle, and you've known him I've met him through you 20 years ago, and you know the chef, and you have fun, and it's a good time. I think for a lot of Americans, they walk in a restaurant like that, and they are intimidated.
Right.
And they feel not relaxed, they're not sure which fork to use, they're not sure how this is going to work, and there are questions. You know, it's like if you can have great food and be relaxed, and that's what I think is great these days. It doesn't have to be, what should I wear? Do I have to wear a jacket? What do I, you know, food should not be snotty and intimidating.
Let's take a break there for a second and remind people that they can call in with their questions or write them in. Our call-in number is 718-497-2128, or you can write us an email at info@heritageradionetwork.com.
We actually did get a question from Northern Spy Food. They want to discuss controlled oxidation as a taste trend.
Wow. Northern Spy Food would like us to discuss controlled oxidation as a taste trend.
And they added kidding, but not really.
Controlled oxidation
as a taste trend. I'm going to defer to you on this one.
Andrew, what is your feeling about controlled oxidation? I'm thinking sherries for some reason, but also perhaps rancid butter or...
I always think of orange wine when you have that kind of oxidation, which is a big trend, which I do. We were actually at Blackbird in Chicago.
No, at Avec next door.
The sister restaurant. Yeah. And I know Adam doesn't really like good wines, so I ordered a good wine.
Let me quote what Nolan said. It's like, all right, I'm going to order this white wine. You're not going to like it, but I'm going to order it anyway. And that was the exact quote. And I was like, and I'm paying for it. Great.
And it was this, it was an orange wine. It was an oxidized wine out of Spain. The Lopez stuff.
If you like oxidized food, you should have gone to the Old Fedora before Gabe took it over and reopened the restaurant. I had a very oxidized, like, tart and chicken liver
pate
there once.
I once wrote an academic paper about the taste of time. Like, if time had a taste, what was it? And to me, it was partly oxidation and umami, because those are processes that sort of happen over time and that for a long time Americans hated. I mean, you know, all of those people who throw away food before the expiration date just in case.
Right.
Kind of thing.
Or and if yet, it has something
in Europe and in Asia, those aged, fermented, old.
Well, why is that? Why are certain things from cheese to hams to kimchi okay to be aged in oxidized? I guess it's
right, but a lot of people don't like them. Not. I mean, the fresh kimchi is a trend now, which is kind of an oxymoron. We have a studio audience here of several Korean North American folks, and they're mashing their faces at the idea of fresh kimchi. I mean, older, better.
Why would one want? Yeah, that's
yeah. Well, and on that completely unrelated note, let's take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. We're talking to Andrew Knowlton and Adam Rappaport. Welcome back to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. Every Wednesday on heritageradionetwork.com, we talk about the issue that I think matters almost more than anything in the world. I say that, of course, with my tongue in my cheek, but taste, I think, is important. In fact, coming up on January 21st, I'm going to be giving a TEDx Manhattan talk on how I think taste, a focus on taste, can in some ways change the way our food system works. Giving some examples of other societies, other food systems, where taste is more important than sometimes I think we consider it here.
How long have you been working on that speech? Because I'd be scared shitless if I was doing that. Are you scared shitless?
I'm getting more scared.
You will be on the internet.
Yes. One of the, they recommend you look at other good speeches, and that's the bad idea. Because I'm mostly terrified at having to memorize it, since my memory is not what it used to be.
They send you like Chomsky and like...
Yeah. You're like, wow, I'm not Liz Gilbert. I'm not going to get some moving motivation.
Exactly. Look, it's just TEDx. It's a baby TED. So yeah.
But that's how you get into TED. That's the farm league.
Speaking about baby things, actually, well, give everyone the details about the TED thing, because you can watch at home, and it's a day of things about food. I mean, it's the theme for TEDx Manhattan. There are all these TEDx events around the country, is changing the way we eat. And that's sort of what we're talking about today, is this idea that the way we eat in restaurants has changed. I think in part, to pick up something you were saying, Adam, our sophistication about food has changed, that we no longer need all the bells and whistles that used to come with spending a lot of money in a restaurant, because we appreciate food in a different way, or we at least understand it better. What do you think of that? Talk about how this has impacted, these changes have impacted the magazine. You are now, you have a legacy magazine that has gone through a lot of changes.
Or one year in, basically, from the changes of the magazine.
1 year, 8 issues in. May was our first issue. In terms of, that's good, you know, first and foremost, we're still a cooking magazine.
Right.
While Andrew certainly is very, very on top of what's going on in the restaurant world, readers expect 40 to 50 recipes a month from us. And of course, some of those are from professional chefs. And you know, my big thing is, which Nolan's heard me going on and on about this, is that, you know, if you're going to get a recipe from a professional chef, you can't just get a recipe from them, because what they cook in a restaurant is not what you cook at home.
Right.
And you know, we're always trying to be ardent about translating those recipes for the home cook, and we'll, if it's ingredients or too many steps or whatever, we're going to hear about it.
So, and this idea of the chef being the source of all food things hasn't always been so, really. I mean, if you look at old Bon Appetit, it's cooking school teachers or cookbook authors who were not historically chefs in the U.S. in the same way. So is there some part of the...
I mean, chefs are celebrity culture for food magazines, and but the problem is that celebrities are not real people, and chefs are not real cooks when it comes to cooking at home, and that's
The recipes don't work.
Yes,
at home,
chefs send us recipes all the time that we ask for, and it's like a 4-year-old. Putting down stuff. I mean, God bless him.
So, but chef's listening. He didn't just say that all chefs are 4-year-olds. No. He just said
the professional kitchen is a completely different beast than the home kitchen.
Right,
you, everything is prepped the night before. You've got your mise en place set out
for you.
You have
a staff. You have dishwashers.
It's more of a, I don't want to say an assembly line, but you assemble dishes more than you cook them in a restaurant. And just cooking at home, having to go out and buy every ingredient from scratch and cut it yourself and mince it. And it's a very different experience. And that's a problem. You can't just... People want restaurant dishes from home. We have that section RSVP.
But they really don't. But they really don't.
Like, I had the best, you know, French onion soup at this little cafe in Denver, Colorado. Can I get that recipe? It's like, well, yes, you can.
Right.
Not sure.
Serves 140.
Yeah.
Right.
So that, like I said, that's an ongoing challenge for us and for any food magazine.
Right.
Because that's what the chefs are, the celebrities of the food world. But they're not really who you should... They're not role models.
Right. Well, they rarely cook at home also. Yes. I mean, themselves.
But that's also why we have, you know, you can't... A lot of magazines that do food don't necessarily have... We have a staff of 6 or 7 people who all they do is in the kitchen testing these recipes.
Yes.
And making them for the home chef. And, you know, you can't... Just because you get a recipe from a chef, you can't just throw it in the magazine. And I think that's a big point that Bon Appetit has always done... That maybe some other, I'm not saying other food magazines, but other magazines that do, like, that's an important thing.
Yeah, we get the recipes and we test them over and over and over again until they work and until they make sense for the home cook. Now, all that said, they can still be difficult, involved recipes.
Right.
And that's up to you as the reader to decide whether or not you want to dive in. It's up to us as the editor to get the balance right in the magazine that there's not too many difficult recipes in there.
And not all of them are the, you know, make 4 courses in 5 minutes, which you know, some people seem to be so
obsessed over.
Yeah.
Right.
My big thing, I'm going to bitch about it right now. My big thing, I just go in this. Nolan's heard me bitch about this. My problem with restaurants today, my biggest issue is, as much as I enjoy the show Top Chef, I think it's had a somewhat negative effect on how chefs cook. You know, went to Girl on the Goat in Chicago, great food. It's food has become competition, and every dish that comes out of the kitchen is a full-on assault with crispy pork cheek and fried egg on top and sriracha sauce.
As though it's all going to judge's table or something.
Well, yeah, and that's great, but that's not a meal, you know, and that's not how you eat, and that's why I always love going to Italy. It's like your primi, your secondi, it all makes sense. You have a little salad, then you have some sliced steak over this, or a simple pasta, and then you've got, you know, a dessert that is not overbearing, and you eat a meal, and in America, you know, I don't think you eat meals anymore.
Interesting. Very interesting.
You know, I heard Nolan say this. I'm sorry, Nolan, just back. But I mean, Andrew Carmelini, one time, I was complaining at Locanda Verde that his food is, I mean, I love Andrew's cooking. It's very flavorful, action packed. I said, it would be nice just with that chicken, whatever, Fra Diavolo, whatever chicken he had there. It would be great if I could just get a side of like steamed or sauteed broccoli. And he said, dude, I can't put that on the menu. Every dish I put on the menu has to be reviewable by the New York Times.
Wow.
It's got to be a dish that you can comment on. You can't, you know, this is not just a simple Italian restaurant. It has to be something that makes a statement. And I find that exhausting.
That's really
well, and I think, and I think a lot of the restaurants these days bludgeon and hit you over the head with every single dish. There is no kind of progression in the dining thing. And that's why I think so many people professional eaters and not professional eaters say, I love the appetizers, but I hated the entrees.
Right.
Well, yeah, that's because you had... You had a pig face, and you had...
You're exhausted by the time.
By the time the entree is...
You know, I don't really know jack about Chinese food, but I do know that when I eat Chinese food, often I'll have, like... Well, first of all, you got some rice on the table, which is a very neutral quality. You have, like... I'll get some simple sautéed bok choy or Chinese broccoli, and then I'll get a couple of flavorful dishes.
In a culture of eating, there's a menu. I mean, you said it about Italy. Any culture. I mean, look at Japan also. The progression isn't just haphazard. It's not a... I mean, part of it is about the me part of America, where, you know... I want this, I want that, I want whatever. But in some other places, there are some rules that you follow about what makes things add up.
Right.
It makes me think of something that our friend Alan Richman said, the great GQ restaurant critic who has worked for Bon Appetit or whatever various times, that he was once challenged about how well he could cook by a chef. And he said that he could cook better than most chefs can eat. Yeah. And in some ways, I think that's really profound.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's not a lot of chefs. I mean, I think Eric Rivera, for instance, we're talking about Le Rendin, that is one restaurant where I've been and I've had five courses and you walk out feeling good.
Right.
And like he has a very keen sense of balance and harmony in his cooking. But I think that's a very much a rarity these days in this country.
Do you think, we heard for a while that, I mean, going back to this idea that chefs sort of are the celebrities of our world, do you think that's going to change? For a while, people thought farmers were going to be the next celebrities, and I know Ruth Reichel did a lot to try to make that happen, but did that happen? I mean, gourmet's gone, but...
Not touching that one. I people always talk about celebrity culture as if it's a new thing in this country.
Right.
And while there is the internet is new, there was certainly a hell of a lot of gossip magazines back in the 1950s. And you know, that hasn't changed, and I don't think it will change. There's always going to be that fascination with celebrities, and I think right now chefs are part of that.
Right. I think
in some ways the celebrities in the food world in the 70s and 80s were those sort of food experts, the Paula Wolfert, the Mata Jaffreys. I mean, they were as famous as, in a different way, in a different time, as the chefs of today.
Yeah, they were. I mean, I think the most crucial thing, selfishly for me, that I think is a problem if you talk about Top Chef or Iron Chef or any of these reality shows and kids wanting to, you know, graduate from school and, you know, own their own restaurant when they're 22, is a lot of chefs say that the quality of cooks out there that they can find aren't there, and people aren't willing to put in the 5 or 6 years. You know, you're not willing to, I don't know, throw, you know, pass Michael Jordan the ball, and you just want to take threes the minute you walk into the league or something
like that. Much more of that. Yeah,
we just watched Jiro Dreams of Sushi, which is a new movie coming out. It's a great documentary about Jiro Ono, one of the great...
Who's 150 years old, you told me the other day, right?
He is. Well, 85. In chef years, he's 150.
He's really well oxidized. Yeah.
But one of the comments that comes out in the commentary is that the first year, practically, all anyone gets to do is squeeze the oshibori, if you're a cook in the kitchen, those little towels that you that you wipe yourself with when you sit down in a Japanese restaurant. That's the first task.
That's the first task.
Right.
Yeah. And can you imagine how long Eric Rivera would keep a chef if all you did was clean scales off of his back kitchen? Yeah.
But maybe we need more reality competition shows about those things. Brunoise, like all the chefs that can actually
I think that is, like, whether you're talking about rising food costs, which is a whole different other topic, and how that's affecting what we pay for what we eat. But also, I think in 2012, I think the talent that, who are these people who are cooking the food? If somebody is, I'm not knocking people, but if you're flying all over the country and you have 100 restaurants, that's great, and you've have a system in place. But if you don't have somebody who can properly execute, if you don't have people work for your magazine who can write or who are out there doing stuff or whatever, you're going to have a mini crisis. And I think that is kind of what Adam was talking about, is sometimes people, what has happened in the past couple of years is fat and those flavors that just bludgeon your palate. That's easy to do. You and I can sit at home and put bacon on something and make it taste good.
Stop putting so much goddamn salt on my French fries. I go to Minetta Tavern or Bal. I mean, I love Minetta Tavern, but like, I can't eat the French fries there. But
I think that's a crutch, and I think that's a lack of experience in chefs who aren't confident in. I'm not saying everything has to be subtle and has to be some Zen experience, but there is
something.
For
more on this topic, listen to my TEDx talk.
No, but it all comes back down to taste, and it's the same thing with fashion. Anyone can walk into a Gucci boutique or Prada or Armani, buy a bunch of expensive clothes, and put them on.
Yeah.
There's very few people who have good taste, who understands what balance is, what harmony is, what goes together well. There's plenty of people can go out there and cook. There's, you know, I was just not a lot can cook that well.
Just chatting with someone who can cook very well, Laurent Gras, about making a menu and what chefs who've worked for him. He's a Michelin 3-star chef 4 times over. Young but very modern approach to French food, to food in general,
and well dressed.
And well dressed. Yeah. Speaking of fashion, exactly. And I asked him what he thought chefs took away from working with him regarding food, and he said knowing when to pull things away, like making things simple, knowing when to just serve an avocado and some crab versus exactly what we're talking about,
gilding the lily.
The obvious, that old Coco Chanel quote about always take off one thing before you leave the house.
Exactly.
You're overdoing it by impulsively.
But do not ever turn off heritageradionetwork.com. We are here every week talking about taste, which we now have on record of Adam Rappaport, editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit magazine, saying it all comes down to taste. Everything comes down to taste and what kind of pants you're wearing, what color pants you're wearing on the day. And Andrew Knowlton, who is the restaurant and drinks editor. Bon Appetit, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Mitchell.
Always fun. We'll have you back soon, I'm sure. In fact, maybe we'll give you your own show. So you can just sit here and kibitz about what you like and don't like. Next week, though, at 11 o'clock, we'll be talking to Dorita Hanna, who is an internationally renowned performance architect who always works with the idea of the table in her work, and this idea of coming together and sort of sharing an experience around a table. And so she'll have some interesting opinions and perspectives, I think, on the performative aspect of eating and food. Until then, you can download us on iTunes. We're a very popular podcast, or listen on heritageradionetwork.com. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.